Great. Thank you very much, and thank you for inviting me to talk to this talk here. So I'm going to be telling you about a number of works today, sort of a summary, really, of a lot of things, talking about many-body localization and tensor networks. And these are my collaborators on various different pieces of this work. And these are pictures of the students and postdocs. So this is my students, Sean Jay and Benjamin, and this is David Luiz, who's a postdoc now at Urbana. So my primary goal is to get through slide one, so at least let me summarize what I'm going to tell you. And I'm certainly not going to make it through all the details of these things, but I hope this at least is sort of an opportunity to tell you some of the things we've been thinking about as a stepping stone to discussions both in the after the talk and later in this conference. So the first thing I'm going to tell you is that we can talk about many-body localization in the language of tensor networks. And in particular, what we now know is that we can, we can efficiently encode all 2 to the n eigenstates using 2n matrices or 4n matrices. So this is sort of a very powerful statement. So there's been a lot of work very early on by people like Bella Bauer and Chaitin Nayak and Isert and company that said, look, these MBL eigenstates individually are matrix product states, so they can individually be encoded by matrices. And this is sort of the next step building on that. That's saying that not only can each eigenstate be represented by a matrix product state, but in a very compact number of matrices, 4n total matrices, we can represent every single 2 to the n eigenstates. And so that's something I'll tell you about in a second. And I think that's very nice. And then using this language, what we're going to be able to do is we're going to be able to write down an objective function for choosing, quote unquote, the best choice of L bits. So what we had heard yesterday from people like David and others is that we had heard that there are lots of different ways that you can write down the L bit Hamiltonian. There's no unique way. And so what this language lets us do, among other things, is it lets us choose, in some sense, a best way, a way that is most local. And this sort of quote-unquote heuristically best way then allows us to do things like look at correlation lengths of different quantities and understand things about the correlations in these systems. And in particular, what we'll show is that there are 2 correlation lengths, one which looks like it diverges at the transition and one that appears not to. Then what I'm going to go on is I'm going to tell you that we too have a series of algorithms to find these matrix product states. So we said that you can represent an eigenstate by a matrix product state in the many-body localized phase, and we have 2 algorithms to do that. So one is ESDMRG. It's sort of a modified DMRG sweeping algorithm. It's actually in practice identical to this other algorithm that Vedika, Frank Pullman, and Shivaji Sande have come up with. And then the other one is SIMS, where we can target a particular energy by propagating with H minus E inverse. So I will then flash up. We can do lots of things with this. We can see that entanglement saturates for big systems. We can see ETH is violated for big systems. We can look at P of S, although I admit we don't have 30,000 samples that Donna has just shown. We can walk out to the mobility edge and look at the mobility edge, and I'll sort of flash some data. I think the most exciting thing, in some sense, is we can look at the local excitations. This is something, so all of these things you could do with ED, but you can only do it on small systems. Getting your hands on these local excitations is really something that's in many ways unique to the matrix product state language. Because of this sort of matrix product state language we have, we can get our hands on these local excitations. And so that's something that's sort of unnatural. It's kind of hard to do in exact diagonalization. Of course, you can just take this language and back it out, but it's much more natural in the matrix product state language. And then I'll tell you 2 quick things at the end. What we're doing in terms of trying to go beyond matrix product states. So particularly, we're trying to do RSRGX, but done better, sort of in a more accurate way through the use of Mira. And some use for Huse-Elster states as a stepping stone, and we're not there yet, to go ahead and do 2 dimensions. And finally, I'll tell you that this is sort of not in tensor networks yet at the moment, but we're working there too. But I'll tell you we have some very preliminary but compelling data about what's going on at the scaling at the MBL transition. OK, so that's a lot of things, but I've succeeded in getting through the summary. So that was my primary goal. And now what I'm going to go is I'm going to tell you about some of these things. And some of them I'll go through and just sort of advertise and flash it up so people can talk about later. So I would say that there are sort of two languages that you can talk about much physics in. And I think that's true for many body localization too. There's sort of a language of thinking about Hamiltonians. And the sort of right thing in the many body localization language is to talk about these L-bits and this L-bit Hamiltonian. And we heard a lot about that yesterday. I'd say there's another language. And in this case, there's sort of a wave function language. What's the right wave function? It's a good question for lots of interesting physical systems. If you can write down a wave function, maybe there are things you can reason about. And sort of the right wave function here is in the terms of tensor networks. So we've already had a very nice talk yesterday by Joel that introduced matrix product states. And what we learned is you can represent a variational matrix product state by two matrices per site, an up and down matrix. And by Abelian notation, I'm going to compress them into a single G, which is a pair of matrices. And so now a ground state would be just represented by these N matrices. And you might imagine, look, I might have some excited state, and I can represent the excited state also by N matrices. And now what I'm going to tell you is actually, if you pick the ground state in the right gauge, and you pick the right excited state in the right gauge, you can now represent all 2 to the n eigenstates as combinatorial combinations of these g's and e's. So that's to say that there is an excitation of the form e1, g2, g3, en. So those 4n matrices represent the entire spectra. Okay, so that's pretty nice. And in addition, up to some lie about Griffith's effects, those matrices don't grow with system size. Okay, so that means that we can talk about all the excitations in this language.
What about the matrix elements? Will they be given by these wave functions directly?
Yeah, I mean, these are the eigenstates. Anything you can compute with eigenstates, any matrix elements you give, will be given correctly by these wave functions. Okay, we can ask ourselves the question, how do we know this? So the way we know this is the following. So this is a little bit of detail in matrix product language. So we learned about matrix product states yesterday. There's also something called a matrix product operator. A matrix product operator is just like a state, but instead of eating a bra and giving out a number, it eats both a bra and a ket. So it gets two spins per site. So you get 4 matrices, possibly. And so that's what it is. And the only piece of information you need to know at the moment about matrix product operators is if it eats a product state, it spits out a matrix product state. And the matrix product state it sticks out is pulling 2 of these matrices per site. So this product state up, down, up, down, up pulls out a G, E, G, E, G. This is just well-known knowledge about matrix product operators. I'd be happy to talk in detail about it. I should say there's a complementary paper to ours by Anusha, Dima, and Geoffrey Vidal and company that says almost the converse of what I'm telling you. Okay, now this is what we've learned. Now let's consider the matrix product operator. You can represent any matrix in this way. The matrix product operator for U, the unitary matrix. A unitary matrix that diagonalizes a Hamiltonian eats a product state and spits out an eigenstate, which is to say, if we were to represent this by a matrix product operator, it will eat a product state down here, and it will stick out an eigenstate up here. And just directly from this piece of information, it follows that all of the eigenstates are structured like that. Now, there's an additional question you might ask. That question is, are those eigenstates of finite bond dimension? And so that's a question that we resolve numerically. What we do is the following. We take chains of different lengths, and we diagonalize them. We get this unitary matrix that I'm talking about. We convert them into the matrix product operator, and we ask, does the bond dimension of these G's and E's grow? And what we find is we find that the bond dimension in the MBL phase appears to saturate. Okay, we get to draw out lots of P of S's, even for the matrix product operator. I'm going to skip that. Now, I've shoved something under the rug, and I'll get back to it in a minute. When we play this game, we have to choose what unitary matrix we want. There are lots of unitary matrices that diagonalize the Hamiltonian. They all differ by a permutation and some signs. Okay, So let me get back to that in a moment. Let me tell you the following first. Given this unitary matrix, we can write out these L-bits that everyone has been talking about, these taus. They're just u, sigma z on site I, u dagger. We can write out the effective Hamiltonian. We can get the alpha ij's that make up the coupling. Given u, we can essentially get everything. It's all fixed by u. And so our only freedom in terms of the L-bits that we have is choosing the right u. And so there are lots of heuristic ways to choose the right u. Essentially, you want a u that minimizes this bond dimension. That's sort of our objective function. That's our goal. If we get a u that minimizes that bond dimension, in some sense, the most local u will declare success. We have lots of heuristics to do this. In our original paper, we had a very nice bipartite matching approach. We've tried lots of things since then. The current winner is this thing called Wegener flow. Wegener flow is essentially a renormalization group technique that slowly diagonalizes sort of far off diagonal energies, sort of energies that are sort of way off the block, and slowly diagonalizes your Hamiltonian. If you diagonalize your Hamiltonian in this way, it turns out that you get the best u. Once you have the best u, you can do all of these things that you want. All right, great. Once we have that, then we can go ahead and play this game where we work out the effective tau bits, we work out their extent, we work out how well they're coupled. So here's our tau bit Hamiltonian. There's some coupling between alpha ij that decays exponentially in the MBL phase. We can measure the correlation length. We can ask how much is the tau bit extended. So we can look at a particular tau bit and we can measure, so we can expand it in terms of the L bits, the physical bits, and we can measure how fast that decays. We can look at a tau bit. We can see how well supported on a given thing. We can measure how fast that decays. We can measure something about the entanglement. So this is unpublished work. My understanding is Vedika and David Hughes have similar thing coming out. And what we see is we see things fall into sort of two groups of correlation lengths, sort of this one here, that is the system size gets bigger, it appears to diverge, and this one here that doesn't appear to diverge. This graph is a little busy, but if we just go back here, these two are the same and they diverge, and these two are the same and appear not to diverge. Okay, so that's all I want to say about that. I'm happy to talk about that in more detail. Let me move on in the next couple of minutes to talk about matrix product states. Yes? Yes. I don't know. I mean, as you see, the transition point, you certainly don't get to read off where it diverges. The transition point that's widely agreed upon is here. So maybe if you do some very careful finite size scaling, you can extract it. It's certainly at the system sizes that we are able to access, not diverging, obviously, where the transition happens. Yes. Okay. So that's a good question. I imagine they compare well because presumably they're all the same thing, but I don't know that. We haven't actually checked that. Okay, great. So there's the response. So the second thing I want to talk about is acquiring eigenstates. So I told you that the eigenstates were matrix product states. How do we acquire them? Let me tell you why that's not an insane thing to try to do to begin with. You might say, look, I'm looking for an eigenstate of this energy. How in the world am I going to distinguish one eigenstate from the other? And so it's known that eigenstates have area laws, and we're going to say something slightly even more powerful than that. If I take two nearby eigenstates and I take a linear superposition of them, it turns out that pure eigenstates, 0 or 1, are local minima of entanglement. And so if you say, look to your computer, look, I'd like an eigenstate at this energy with low entanglement, with locally minimal entanglement, that should, in theory, give you an eigenstate, even though there's a huge degeneracy there. So we spent a long time developing two algorithms. It's kind of interesting to look at sort of the historical evolution of this. We keep giving talks, and we always talk about two algorithms, but the two algorithms keep getting better. So this was last year in Dresden in March meeting. We talked about sort of this ESDMRG, which hasn't changed in a while. But for a while, we were doing energy targeting with H minus E squared. And this is the problem that Vedika was talking about, that you take a dense spectra and make it a really dense spectra. In addition, we did this a lot, and there's sort of an entanglement barrier. And so we've switched over to doing H minus E inverse. which we've cutely called SIMPs, for shift and invert matrix product states. And we find that that is much more reliable and works much better. So there are lots of now beautiful results for doing DMRG in different ways. I am completely unbiased, but I think ours are the best. There's some nice things. So this is our current state of the art. And I think this is as far as we're going to go with matrix product states, but we're pushing, and I'll say like half a slide on each, for different tensor network formulations to be able to capture things that we can't easily capture in matrix product states. OK. Yes? Ask David. No. OK. It'll take me too long to explain it here. I will happily tell you in detail afterwards. OK, so what are we doing in SIMPs? We're essentially doing a power method. So you might say, look, typically people do a power method with 1 minus tau h or e to the minus beta h. We're doing a power method with h minus e inverse. This requires building up a lot of machinery to figure out how to take one matrix product state and then produce the next matrix product state after the application of h minus e inverse. Needless to say, we've spent a long time and figured out how to do it, and it works really well. We have some energy. We come down to the right energy. We have entanglement, we come down to the right entanglement, and very few power iterations. Okay, we have ESDMRG. As I said, this is identical to an algorithm Vedika and Frank have in practice. This is just a trace of that. This is the fidelity with the final state we get. This is the difference in energy. As we sweep, we get fairly good things. Let me tell you how ESDMRG works. Typical DMRG, you sort of walk back and forth, you sweep back and forth. At each step, you have an effective Hamiltonian. You sit on that effective Hamiltonian, and you pick the ground state. And then you sweep right, and you sit on the effective Hamiltonian, and you pick the ground state. Now we're no longer picking the ground state. We're picking an excited state, and we have a heuristic for picking the excited state. Vedika has a slightly different heuristic, but actually when you run them, they're exactly identical in the excited states they choose. And right, you sweep back and forth, and you hit some fixed point, and that fixed point is an excitation. So it's sort of a 10-line modification for a typical DMRG code, and it seems to work fairly well. The downside of this is you don't get to pick an energy. With SIMPs, I get to say I want energy 8.37, and I get to find a state right at that energy. Here, you don't have that kind of control. You just sweep back and forth, and you get lots of states. OK, we're obsessive about verifying that it works. I mean, the problem is that you really, really have to worry that somehow you're getting a linear superposition of eigenstates and not a single one. We compare it against ED. We've done, for all different system sizes, these probabilities of entanglements that people have been talking about. The thing in terms of sort of validation that I like the best is for big systems, we rerun our algorithm a bunch of times. And if we were getting stuck in linear superpositions of states, you would expect that our overlap of these states would be like a half some of the time or a quarter or something. And we find always that as we run our algorithm, the fidelity between nearby states are either 0 or 1. So this is sort of a heuristic to check for the quality of our states, even for big systems. So this is a summary of how well it works. This is disorder. This is the standard deviation. So other people are reporting the variance. So you have to normalize, right? We can do 100 sites here. We can do 30 sites is this blue, 40 sites is this yellow. Even at 100 sites, we're getting pretty good data. We're getting down to a variance of 10 to the minus 10. So we're pretty happy with that. And every indication is this works pretty well. So we've also done sort of sanity checks to make sure, as best we can tell, that we're not biased, that we're not getting some sort of biased thing. So now what we can do is we can take this information, and we can go on, and we can take this method, and we can go on, and we can check things. So one of the things you might want to check is you might want to check how the entanglement scales in the MBL phase. And OK, so open squares means we don't trust it. The standard deviation of our results is kind of large. But for places where we trust it out to 5, there's every indication that the entanglement saturates. OK, this is not unexpected, but it's nice to be able to do that out at system sizes of 30 or 40, so sort of a factor of 2 bigger than other people can do. And we can go out to 100 and probably more if we want. But this is reported for 30 and 40. So the entanglement seems to saturate in the MBL phase, and it looks like actually we're getting pretty good data out to a disorder strength of 3, sorry, out to a disorder strength of 4, and then past 4 we get garbage. So it's an interesting fact that the transition is between 3 and 4, and so there seems to be every indication that we're walking right up to the breakdown of the MBL phase and still getting good data. In fact, I think we're getting, I think even in the ergodic phase, I think this algorithm works, but the size of the MPS that you need is so large that we just can't run at the bond dimension required. Yes? I'm sorry? So blue is ED. Blue is exact diagonalization. Oh, you should be able to write it. I'm pretty sure that's a good question.
20 log 2.
Yeah, 20 log 2.
13.
So you're between top and top.
Yeah, so once you're in the ergodic phase, I mean, the data is garbage, right? Because your bond dimension doesn't grow exponentially. Your bond dimension is 60, and it would need to be something much larger. And in fact, we see it's garbage. We see that the standard deviation, our metric for sort of quality of goodness, is large. Oh, I don't know. Some are hundreds, some are thousands, some are. I mean, I don't remember every disorder average for each one. I mean, certainly we didn't do 30,000 for any individual configuration. Well, ED, I think ED, we probably did much larger than that. We probably drove ED to death. The MPSs are much slower than running ED. Okay, we can go ahead and test ETH. One of the nice things about SIMPs is we get to target an energy. So notice the scale here. We're going from minus 0.1 to 0.1. And this is ED data because we want to be in the ergodic phase and we can't go to the ergodic phase with our current algorithms. And okay, it's nice and banded depending on the value of S sub Z. And this is the equivalent data for a much bigger system size for 30. We have bigger than this, but I'm just showing 30. And what we see is we see for this very small energy range that although it's extremely banded in energy in the ergodic phase, it's all over the place in the MBL phase. So this is sort of a extremely clean and very nice validation of the breakdown of the eigenstate thermalization hypothesis in the language of sort of in the matrix product states. Okay, so we can also play some games and look at the mobility edge, so I won't show a lot of data here, but what we're doing is we are sitting at some value 3, which is in the mobility edge if you believe the exact diagonalization, which we do, and you walk down from high energy density, and essentially what you see, this is e to the s, you see that the entanglement is sort of a small constant for a while, then there's some kink and something explodes, and then, well, we don't know for sure what's going on here, but almost certainly our bond dimension runs out of steam and things go haywire. But we essentially are able to see a mobility edge right around the point where the exact diagonalization shows it. There's not a huge amount of data here, so I wouldn't like promise it's here as opposed to here once you do everything kind of cleanly, but this is sort of some preliminary data. The thing that I think I'm most excited about in this matrix product state language is, in addition for an algorithm to find a single matrix product state, a single eigenstate, we also have another algorithm to find a whole slew of local excitations. So what we do in that case is the following. We have an eigenstate. It's represented as a matrix product state. And then we go to some site. On that site, there's an effective Hamiltonian. And then we take the other excitations, the other eigenstates of the effective Hamiltonian on that site. And then what we do is we check their standard deviation, and we show that many of them are pretty good eigenstates. Many of them have low standard deviation. Some of them are garbage. The ones that are garbage, we don't show. The ones that are good eigenstates, we show. And so this is a plot of that. So what am I doing here? There's 30 sites. On each site, I'm doing this. On site 1, I'm drawing out the effective Hamiltonian. I'm picking states. On site 15, I'm drawing the effective Hamiltonian. I'm picking states. These gray lines are the energies, the eigenvalues of the states that we find. And this is the target state. This is the state we started with that I produced all these local excitations from. And these different colors correspond to whether we did we found the same state. So here, we did it on sites 17 and 18, we found the same state. It's not surprising, these are local. If we do it on sites 17 or 18, it's not particularly surprising we find the same state. And so you can see that here. So this goes to, so there's been a lot of talk by Dima and others about sort of this G of L, that's sort of one metric of looking at sort of excitations. These are not necessarily nearest neighbor eigenvalues, but these are eigenvalues in a small energy spread. And you can essentially take this and you can look at where the excitations are local. And if you have two excitations that are highly non-local with respect to each other, then their overlap is going to be zero. So I think this has some nice relations to some of the things that have been talked about earlier. And this now gives us, from one eigenstate, thousands of other eigenstates essentially for free. Yes? Energy. That's right, total energy. So this is the energy of the state we started with. And these are... Yeah, that's right.
That's pretty amazing. So you can excite into by a factor of 10.
Yeah, locally we produce excitations all over the place.
Single particle,
but you're in the.
Well, okay. The W here, yeah, J is 1. I mean, the Heisenberg coupling is 1, so that's order 1. The field is 8 or something here. So it depends what you mean.
Single spin energies that are 16.
That's right. So, okay. That's.
So that's the range.
Sorry, our units are 1, but that's right. We have an H running around that's disordered. Yeah, no, that's fair. So that's good. OK, good. Other questions? OK, now I'm just going to flash 3 more slides. So to begin with, we've taken RSRGX, and we've said to ourselves, look, that's essentially a tensor network. And so we should be able to actually translate that for real into a tensor network. And then what we should be able to do is we should make these gates in the tensor network larger, which is essentially a way of taking RSRGX and making it better and better. And so this is still a work in progress, but this is what we've done. These are eigenstates sort of 20% in the spectrum. This is a little bit hard to see. I apologize. This is on small systems. The exact diagonalization is in blue. The red is doing sort of unitary gates of size 1. You notice the red is not tracking the blue. The green is doing unitary gates of size 5. The green is talking the blue. I have no time left, I'm being told. Good. We're trying to push Hughes Elster states to do 2 dimensions. I have some data on what's going on at the critical point that I don't seem to have time to show. And these are my conclusions.
Okay.
Can you show the data at the critical point?
Sure. Okay, so there are, I should say, this is compelling but preliminary data. So what we've done is the following. We have looked at what we believe to be the critical point adjusted for finite size scaling. And we have looked at the entanglement entropy. And we have rescaled L in an appropriate way. And what we believe, based on very preliminary, albeit compelling, evidence, is that there is a volume law slope at the transition point of a slope that is half, okay, we've only looked at infinite temperature, but is infinite temperature divided by 2 is essentially a half. So that's one thing. The other thing we've done is the following. So we have a beautiful proof that builds on this work of Tarun using ideas of subadditivity that shows that if we average a particular disorder configuration appropriately with an appropriate sliding window, that the curves that come out of that are monotonic and smooth. And so for each disorder pattern, we can actually look at the slope. And what we are able to show is we are able to show that at the critical point, these slopes are essentially flat. There's a histogram distributed over all values. And what that implies is the same thing I just said, that at the critical point, things are volume law with a slope that is half the infinite temperature value. OK, I know that was a bit fast. I'm happy to talk to people in more detail in person.
OK, other questions? Okay. Well, we had a lot of questions during the talk, so we can finish right on time. Thank you.
Thank you.